Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. Although often overlooked today, whether or not to eat food that had been sacrificed to idols was a major issue in first century Christianity, especially in urban centers like Corinth. The city was teeming with temples, idols, and smaller shrines. Divinities abounded, and devotees made offerings regularly, from a little wine poured out at a home shrine to full animal sacrifices, amid the pomp and circumstance of a city-funded celebration in the main forum. It's hard for us to imagine the immense social pressure, especially on elite Christians, to attend state sacrifices, eat meals at temple dining rooms, and accept invitations to banquets at which meats from animals sacrificed to the gods would be served. Join me to see what the idolatry landscape was like in Corinth and how Paul instructed the Christians there to navigate the situation with fidelity and grace. Here now is episode 592, part 9 of our 1 Corinthians in Context class, Food Sacrificed to Idols.
I'd like to begin with 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1. We'll be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It reads, "Now concerning food sacrificed to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Anyone who claims to know something does not yet have the necessary knowledge, but anyone who loves God is known by Him." So we can see that we have a slogan here, as indicated by the quotation marks, all of us possess knowledge. This is something the Corinthians were saying and to which Paul is responding. Now, Paul's not endorsing a universal anti-intellectualism here. He's not saying that education is bad. He's talking about a specific kind of knowledge, a specific context. Paul Gardner writes about this. He says, "We, the truly spiritual people at Corinth, know that we all possess knowledge. Being puffed up," because that's what Paul says, he says, "you are puffed up. Being puffed up involves the flaunting of something for one's own benefit or to stress one's own status." So this is a major issue of what was happening. They had a knowledge, and they were using that knowledge to inflate their status over against those who didn't have this knowledge. What knowledge are we talking about? Let's look at the next verse, verse 4. "Hence, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that no idol in the world really exists, and that there is no God but one." In each of these quotations, they begin with the word "that," and that signals to us that Paul is actually quoting them. So the first quote is that they're saying no idol in the world really exists. This is that knowledge that they're claiming to have. And they're saying there's no God but one. Now, both of these are very fine statements. I don't think most of the Corinthian slogans are bad. I think they just are being used in a way that they were not intended to be used for. A hammer is not bad, but if you hit your finger with it, it is bad, right? So you're supposed to hit a nail with a hammer, not your finger. So it is here. They believe no idol in the world really exists. The idol is not really a god, it's a statue. And there's plenty of Old Testament verses that say things like, these idols, they have eyes, but they cannot see, they have ears, but they cannot hear, and there's all kinds of statements like that, criticizing idol worship. And so this would fit right in with that, that's no problem. And then the other statement, there is no God but one, It's true. There's only one who is above all. There's only one who is called Yahweh in the Old Testament, or Jesus calls the Father. And he is certainly supreme. But there are also other spiritual beings that exist apart from God. And Paul talks about this in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, just to jump over to another epistle for a second. "For our struggle," he says, "is not against blood and flesh, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. So there are other spiritual forces than the one God who is above all. And both Corinthian statements are true, but at the same time, they're being used in a way that's not good. And so Paul is going to, in a sense, sympathize with them and the truth that they do have, because they do have truth, but then also adjust a little bit how they're applying these truths, and especially with reference to other Christians that are getting offended by what they're doing. Let's see what's next. 1 Corinthians 8:5 says, "Indeed, even though there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as in fact there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist." So Paul begins with their way of looking at it. He says, there may be so-called gods in heaven and on earth. So that's him throwing them a bone. He's like, yeah, you know, they're so-called gods. But then, like, in a parentheses kind of statement, he's like, well, there are actually many gods and many lords. So he sort of, like, gives them a little bit, but then explains a little bit. And he outlines this idea of subjectivism. So for you versus for me. So for the Romans, there are many gods and many lords, but for us Christians, there's one God and one Lord. Do you see how he made that move there? That makes sense. Now, verse 6, we're going to come back to next session. We're going to get into the weeds there. But for now, let's just look at the big picture. I want you to understand the gods and lords of Corinth, because if you do, I think it'll help you understand the pressure to participate in idol meat, whether at a festival or at another time. So let's go through the gods in Corinth. I'm going to give you a list of all the ones that I could find based on archaeology and ancient literary sources. The first up is Sisyphus. Sisyphus, I think, was a guy to start, but he gets deified. Gods, in the Roman world, gods can become men, and men can become gods, and women as well. Goddess, women. They have women gods and male gods and so forth. So Sisyphus has a temple that a couple of eyewitnesses spotted, Strabo and Pausanias, on the Acro-Corinth. The Acro-Corinth, I've mentioned to you before, is a rock outcropping right next to the city of Corinth. In fact, they built a wall to enclose this within the city of Corinth officially. And that's a defensive decision because the city could retreat to the top of this fortress, basically, natural fortress, and then be able to defend itself. Athens has the same sort of thing. The tallest building in the United States of America is the World Trade Center at 541 meters, and the Acro-Corinth is 575. So it's even taller than the tallest building in America. It's rather abrupt when you look at it. It doesn't sort of like gradually go up. It just sort of like poof, shoots out of the ground. And ancient people saw this and they said, well, this is obviously a high place. It's a holy place. We should build temples there. So that's what they did. And so Sisyphus had ruins of a temple around there somewhere. The second god I want to mention, I'm kind of going from lesser to greater here, is Isis. Isis is an Egyptian god. She had a sanctuary at Kenkrei Harbor. Now, if you don't remember, Corinth is in the middle here. To the right side there, we have Kenkrei, that's one of the ports, and then the other port is Lechaim. And then, so this is Corinth, the city itself, and then the Acro-Corinth is right next to it, okay? So I'm including all of this in my survey, because if you have a god that's being worshipped in Kenkrei or Lechaim, then that's just as good to me as Corinth or Acro-Corinth. Isis had two precincts in the Acro-Corinth as well. So this Egyptian goddess is being worshipped in Kenkrei, in the harbor there, and also at the Acro-Corinth. Next up, we have Serapis. Serapis is another Egyptian god. He was getting to be very popular in the first century among non-Egyptian people. He had two sanctuaries also on the Acro-Corinth. I'm telling you, this stone was loaded with sacred space for different gods. Next up, we have Diana. You might have heard of her. She's a big deal in Ephesus. I'm giving the Roman name, but there's also the Greek name, would be Artemis. Diana had a temple and a wooden image on the road to Kenchreae from Corinth. And there was a statue of Artemis, surnamed Ephesian, at the forum. Now, if you are a god and you get yourself a statue in the forum, that's a premium location. So the forum, if you recall, is a wide, flat, open space where government stuff happened, religious stuff happened, and shopping. Diana had a statue that was somewhere in the forum there. Next up, we have Fortuna, also called Tyche. And this is the temple, this god, or I should say goddess, excuse me. This goddess had a temple at the forum. So I don't know if you saw this, but at the forum, we have, of course, we got the two big boys, right? These two. But then there's all these little temples. There were big shrines and there were little shrines, you know? So you have big gods, a little god. Everything is taken care of, but it's not considered equal. So Fortuna is a smaller god, but she did have a little temple or a little shrine of some sort in the forum, that Pausanias mentions. Then we have Bacchus, also called Dionysus, and that's the party god, the god of wine and just orgies and stuff like that. And so he had two wooden images at the forum. They were covered with gold with his face painted red. And Pausanias mentions that. Then we have Mercury, also called Hermes, who had two bronze standing images at the forum. And one of them had a little shrine in the forum area of Corinth. Then you have Hercules, which is the Greek Heracles. For him, there was a naked wooden statue by the theater, rumored to have been made by Daedalus, which was a very famous sculptor. So Hercules was a little more highly honored. Makes sense because Corinth is the city out of which we get the Isthmian Games, which is like basically like the Olympics. You have a lot of athletes coming and going. The athletes like Hercules. So it makes sense that he would have a privileged position in the city. Then we have Minerva, also called Athena. She's the goddess of wisdom, strategy, of the arts, and often depicted with an owl. She's also associated with war, and the coins that we have of, well, they wouldn't call her Minerva during the Greek phase, but the earlier Greek coins, she would be called Athena. It's a woman's head, but she's wearing a soldier's helmet, but like the helmet is lifted up. So you can still see her face, but the soldier's helmet is on her. She's like wearing it like a hat. And so you see a lot of these coins from the Greek period, but none in the Roman period, at least none that I could find. So she was still a big deal. They called her Minerva now instead of Athena, but it wasn't dominating like it was in the Greek phase before. She had a bronze statue on a pedestal with a relief of Muses at the forum and a sanctuary next to the theater. So once again, premium real estate. Because you go to a show, you're going to see the Temple of Minerva. So she was a big deal. And that was likely built in the first century BC. Next up, we have Venus, also called Aphrodite, the goddess of love, beauty, romance, fertility. She was also thought to be the ancestor of the Roman people. And they had a whole way of basically jacking into the story, the Greek story about Troy and Aeneas and all that. And somehow they make him the founder of Rome. So the Romans are really just Trojans. It's a great move, I think, but not likely to be true. Venus had a temple and a stone statue at Kenchreae. She also had a shrine at Lechium with a dining hall nearby. This is something you see with temples a lot. Temples have animal sacrifices. Animal sacrifices means barbecue. Barbecue means you need dining halls so that people can sit, or at least well-to-do people can sit and eat. Poor folks are just going to eat out in the street. But then the wealthier people will have these dining halls. And so that there was a temple with dining halls of Venus in Lechium. There was also a statue at the Forum and at the Acrocorinth. Venus was a big deal. Corinthians liked Venus. At the summit of Acrocorinth, at the very top, was her temple. And there were all kinds of sayings about Corinth and Aphrodite or Venus and about how important she was to the city. Next, we have Ceres and Corey. These are goddesses of agriculture and fertility. The myth with them goes like this. Pluto, which is the Roman way to say Hades, the god of the underworld, of the realm of the dead, Pluto kidnapped Kore and brought her to the underworld. And Ceres was so upset about this that she stopped allowing plants to grow. So like there was no fertility on Earth. There were no plants growing. So Zeus had to step in, which the Romans would call Jupiter. He stepped in and he said, all right, let's strike a compromise. How about Pluto? Why don't you hand back Kore? Why don't you hand her back for half the year? And then she could live with you for half the year. She could live up here for half the year. They said, all right, fine. And that's why we have seasons. Right? So when Kore goes down to the underworld, that's when all the crops die. And then when she comes back up, we have spring. So that's how they thought about that. This was a goddess and her daughter. Okay, Ceres is the mother, Kore is the daughter, or in the Greek is Demeter and Persephone. And this was the classic word for it is cult, but I think our modern sense of that word is not very good for this. This was a goddess or a goddess pair that was exclusive to women. Guys were not going to the temple of Ceres and Kore. And if they did, probably bad things happened because that was kind of a woman's place. And we have a little quote from Joran Oakland here in the book Corinth in Context. She writes, ritual dining by women worshipers was central to the cult. Did you catch that? Women gather and they eat. Ritual dining. You see that? So ritual dining by women worshipers was central to the cult. It was an activity that celebrated the fruits of the earth and female companionship, as well as the one that promoted human fertility. Over 40 dining rooms from the Greek period have been excavated at the site, in addition to a theater up the hillside. Mummius' sack of Corinth did not result in destruction of the sanctuary, but the period of the city's abandonment did cause the buildings to deteriorate. We do not know how this Corinthian sanctuary was used during the 2 centuries after the official Greek cult finished and before the Roman refurbishment of the sanctuary sometime after 77 CE. It is clear, nevertheless, that there was no clear break between the time of the city's abandonment and the early Roman period. Finds of pottery and kitchen vessels, for example, in addition to lamps, minor cultic vessels, and coins, indicate that the newcomers to Corinth joined existing activities and may have used the sanctuary's pre-existing buildings when they resumed cult activity. So, archaeologists have found the temple of Demeter or Ceres and Kore or Persephone, depending on if we're in the Greek period, which was originally built for Demeter and Persephone, but when the Romans moved in, they called them Ceres and Kore. So they found this place, and you know what's so strange what they found there? They found all these lead curse tablets where you would pay somebody to write a curse on a little plaque of lead. Write a curse against your business enemy. Write a curse against your personal enemy. That girl that you were after, some other guy swooped her up. Write a curse against that guy. And so they would write all these curses. And like there's just tons and tons of curses found in the vicinity of this temple inside, just outside of downtown Corinth, dating from the 4th century BC to the 2nd century AD. So that's a lot of centuries of cursing your enemies. And they would bury them. And that's why it's really good for archaeology, because like the archaeologists are like, yo, check out this curse tablet. It's not even worn. You know, they buried it. They believed it was effective there because Ceres and Kore were associated with the underworld. She goes to the underworld for half the year. So maybe she could take your curse down there, talk to Pluto, get things done. All right, next up we have Neptune, also called Poseidon, a powerful but temperamental god of sea, storms, and horses. Associated with the Corinthian Isthmus, he had a temple and bronze statue at the Lechium Harbor. He had a bronze statue at Kenkrei. Both harbors were places of worship for Poseidon. He also had a bronze statue above a fountain at the Forum in Corinth. And I've mentioned this before, which I would not be surprised if you don't remember. But there was a fountain in the Forum. It's a lovely thing, right? You go there, you get water. and there is Neptune or Poseidon, and there's water. It makes sense. He's the god of the sea. We also have four coins from the year 50 or 51 during the reign of Claudius. These are coins minted right before Paul had gotten there. These are coins that on the left side have the head of Helios, which is the sun god. And then on the right side of each has a naked human form. He's carrying a dolphin in his right hand, and he has a trident in his left hand. And that's the god Neptune or Poseidon. And so, yeah, if you're putting it on the tail side of all your coins, that's kind of like saying this guy's a big deal in your city. Next up, we have Aesculapius, or Asclepius is how we say it in Greek. I was thinking Aesculapius would be a great curse word replacement, right? You stub your toe and you're like, Aesculapius, you know, like, it just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? So this is a god of medicine and healing, typically pictured with a staff and a snake wrapped around it, which is used by medical agencies to this day. He had a sanctuary at the Kenkrei Harbor. He had a major temple in Corinth, very important temple. I'm going to show you a little bit more about that. Bronwyn Wickeser says, individuals flocked to Asclepia, that's Asclepius' temples, in search of cures for maladies ranging from blindness, deafness, and paralysis to headaches, baldness, and insomnia. Here, the sick would sleep, hoping to meet Asclepius in a dream, whereby he would treat them with a medical procedure or prescribe a regimen for cure. So, did you catch that? You go to the Asclepian, which is a temple that has lots of amenities, by the way. I'm going to get into that in a second. But it also is a place where sick people especially, were expected to sleep. And you would incubate, you would sleep there, and then in the night, a dream would come, and you would get enlightenment to know how to get cured of your problem. If you did receive healing of some sort, you would take some clay, and you would make a replica of the body part and leave it behind as a votive gift to the god and as a, you know, basically a thank you. And we have lots of these body parts that the archaeologists have found, arms and legs and heads and other parts of your body. It's really something. The sick would have dedicated these clay body parts to Asclepius, either in request or of thanksgiving for healing. Most are pierced by holes for suspension from a ceiling or more often from walls. Beyond the temple was a courtyard, and there were three dining rooms. Triclinium is what we call a dining room because it had three sides of which four couches to recline on. And you could fit about 11 people in each of the dining rooms in the Asclepion. Murphy O'Connor says, it is entirely probable that the wealthier members of Paul's flock have been wont to repair to the Asclepion for recreation. It was probably the closest the city had to a country club with facilities for dining and swimming. It would have been natural to continue going there after conversion, because even though the converts no longer believed in the healing god, they still would have seen the value of the site. You may have to go to the Asclepion for business meetings, not during a time when an animal is being sacrificed or there's an official worship event, but just for social reasons. Bronwyn Wickeser once again says, Asclepius typically treated chronic rather than fatal ailments, and according to mythic tradition, was prohibited by his grandfather Zeus from bringing individuals back to life. The Christian message about Jesus thus promised a type of cure that Asclepius could not. It promised a cure for death. I thought that was pretty powerful. I mean, just thinking about Jesus versus the gods here for a second, like he's offering something that Asclepius can't do, namely resurrection. Apollo is the next god I want to mention. Apollo is the son of Zeus or Jupiter, the god of the sun. It's interesting. The Romans didn't even bother with a Roman name for Apollo. They just took the Greek name. They're like, all right, Apollo, whatever. So they just took it on. This is a god usually pictured with a lyre, which is kind of like a miniature harp, or a bow. He's the patron god of Augustus, the first Roman emperor, who was rumored to be the son of Apollo. He had a bronze statue at the Forum and a really serious temple. It's labeled number one on the map. The Apollo Temple is a big deal. The Apollo Temple was situated between the main Forum on its northern side, as well as on the southern side of the northern Forum. So the Apollo Temple sits right in between them. So it's like premium real estate, like the best, most sought after central location of the city. And it was a big temple. It only has today, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It only has today 7 standing columns. Very sad, but not so sad either. I mean, these are pagan gods. But it would be nice to have seen the temple in all of its glory. I think that would be really interesting archaeologically to see. But yeah, so not much left of it, but it had already been 6 centuries old by the time Paul got there, and they had just finished refurbishing it in the first century before Paul got there. So it was probably gleaming. It was really nice. Could not miss it. All right. Then we have, last but not least, Jupiter, not the planet, but the god, also known as Zeus. He has 3 images in the open Forum. So yeah, overpowered, right? Like, this guy is well represented. One of those images doesn't have a surname. The other one is called Zeus of the Underworld. And then the third, Zeus Most High. Probably Temple E was a temple of Jupiter. Scholars debate this. That's the temple that is on the west side of the Forum, directly across from the Julian Basilica. I'll talk about the Julian Basilica later. It's the largest temple in Corinth, and it's likely that it was Jupiter based on the fact that Pausanias said above the theater is a sanctuary of Zeus, and so it is fairly close to the theater, I guess. But you know, there's some debate on that. Okay, so that's 16 gods in Corinth, right? Or its immediate neighbors. And surely, I just want to make this point, surely there were more than 16. These are just the ones that left tracks, that left archaeological remains, or that ancient people mention in writing. There could have been 50 gods. I don't know. Right? Because in addition to these 16 fairly famous gods, you also had the domestic worship. So every house had a lar and penates that hung out in the cupboard. And then you had the hearth god, Vesta. And then you had the genius of each of the different paterfamiliae, all these family ancestral spirits or protective spirits. And then at crossroads, there were gods at the crossroads too. There was a lar for every crossroad. Or there would be a little shrine for Mercury or a goddess named Trivia at crossroads. And then there were the emperors. Romans gave divine honors to certain emperors and their relatives. Okay? They don't call them gods like the Latin word dei. They call them instead divinities, the Latin word divi, okay? Or divis would be a singular. All right, so first up with them, we have Julius Caesar. Of course, he's a big deal. He started Corinth, then he got stabbed to death by the Senate. And then 2 years later, they decided he was a god. They voted him to be deified as a god after they murdered him. You just can't make this stuff up. It's incredible. So there's a building called the Julian Basilica on the east side of the Forum. And it had an 8-foot marble statue of Divus Julius, the divine Julius, or Julius the divinity, something like that. It also honored his family, including later emperors, and it was a typical downtown governmental building. It wasn't a temple. It was a government building that the governor of the entire province, the province of Achaia, that's where he would work. He would work in the Julian Basilica. But even though it was a government building, it had a shrine, it had a big old statue out front, and sometimes offerings were made to the gods, namely Julius Caesar and his family in this government building. There's no concept of separation of church and state here. And they also found statues of Gaius and Lucius and Augustus and possibly Claudius, but seven more of the statues were unidentified. So that's kind of sad, but what you gonna do? Next up, we have Augustus. He's called the son of a god because Julius Caesar was deified by vote of the Senate, which means that Augustus, as the adopted son, is a son of a god. And he had a big marble statue in the Julian Basilica. Well, not huge, but, you know, fairly decent size, like a human size, slightly bigger than a human. I should have had somebody stand next to that statue when I saw it in the museum so I could, you know, for perspective. Anyhow, he also had a massive bronze statue in the forum. This statue was 8 to 10 feet tall, and it had an 8-foot cylindrical base with four benches at the bottom, meaning that it would be a 16-foot towering hulk in the middle of the forum. And this guy wasn't Zeus, he wasn't Jupiter, he wasn't Apollo. This was a dead Roman emperor. And he had a big statue. And the inscription read, Divus Augustus. There was also probably a shrine and a statue at the 10 shops, which we won't get into. Then we have Octavia. Octavia's interesting. She's not an emperor. Why is she getting divine honors? Well, she's the sister of Augustus and the wife of Mark Antony. So she had a small shrine of sorts that Pausanias saw when he went there in the second century near the forum. And then we have Augustus's two grandsons, which he adopted as sons, Gaius and Lucius. Both of them died in their 20s and were not divinized by the Roman Senate, but in Corinth, they were like, you know what? We're gonna make statues of these guys. We're gonna honor them as if they were Castor and Pollux, which goes into a myth that I'm not gonna get into. But they gave them these statues in these prominent locations as well. Then we have Tiberius. Tiberius was disliked. People didn't like him. And the Roman Senate very intentionally did not give him divine honors. Though there's one Corinthian poet that did mention him using the word God, but we're not going to count Tiberius. We're going to say that he was kind of a loser in the end, just didn't really win the people's love. Which brings us to Livia. Livia definitely won the people's love. That's Augustus's wife. So after Augustus dies, his family adopts her and changed her name to Augusta. So Livia is Augusta, and her grandson, Claudius, is the emperor when Paul goes to Corinth. So she's a big deal. In Corinth, we find three inscriptions giving her divine honors. Then we have Caligula. He was a terrible emperor. Nobody liked him. In fact, he was the first emperor to have his memory damned, which means that, and it's the Latin phrase, damnatio memoriae, which means that every mention of Caligula, and that's not even his real name, that's the name they used to make fun of him, but it stuck. Every mention of this guy in buildings, in statues, the sculptors were commanded to go and erase completely. So no divine honors for him, that's for sure. And then finally we have Claudius. We have an inscription that calls him Divi Claudii, and a statue that mentions Divo Claudio, and possibly a statue in the Julian Basilica, which I already mentioned. So this whole family, the Julio-Claudian family, like I've said before to you, this was a big deal in Corinth. They cared about these people, even though these people other than Claudius are all deceased by the time Paul's there. They've got statues everywhere. And they even have priests. Priests for Julius. A priest for Augustus. We have confirmed those two for sure, and likely many more as well. It's called a flamen. A flamen is a priest dedicated to a specific god. And so that is eight more. Actually, not eight more. Six more. So that's 22 gods so far, okay? 22 that can compete for honors and worship. And so that brings us to some important questions. Question number one, should Christians participate in ceremonies honoring gods? Question number two, can Christians eat at a temple dining room if it's not during a religious service, during a sacrifice? In other words, can you rent it out and go with your friends and have a meal there? Number three, can Christians eat the meat from the animal sacrificed when it's sold the next day in the meat market? And question four, what if you're at a dinner party and they serve you meat from an idol sacrifice? Should you always ask to find out, or is it okay? So these are four questions that Paul answers in 1 Corinthians 8 and also in chapter 10. Let's take a look at what he says. Verse 7, it is not everyone, however, who has this knowledge. Back to, if you remember, he was talking about, okay, you guys say you have knowledge. Here's the knowledge I have. Idols are not real, and there's no God but one. And he's like, yeah, but not everybody has this knowledge that you have. Since some have become so accustomed to idols until now, they still think of the food they eat as offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not bring us close to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if, and he's talking about Christians, weak Christians. For if others see you, who possess knowledge, eating in the temple of an idol. See, now we're getting specific. Now we're finding out, what are we talking about, Paul? What are we talking about here? We're talking about eating in the temple of an idol. And if others see you, who possess knowledge, eating in the temple of an idol, might they not, since their conscience is weak, be encouraged to the point of eating food sacrificed to idols? So by your knowledge, the weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed. But when you thus sin against brothers and sisters and wound their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Whoa. Therefore, if food is a cause of their falling, I will never again eat meat, so that I may not cause one of them to fall. Anthony Thistleton writes about this. He says, Christians in Corinth, who perhaps designated themselves as the strong in knowledge and or social economic influence, claimed that knowledge encouraged a more enlightened attitude toward taking part in festivals and meals in the precincts of pagan temples. Knowledge informs us that an idol has no real existence, for there is no God but one. So Christians may, on this basis, maintain their business and social contacts. And I think that's a lot of what we're talking about here when we're talking about eating at a temple. We're not talking about attending a service of a sacrifice. We're talking about renting out a room at the Asclepion or one of these other temples on a Tuesday night because you're having a business deal, or because you want to meet that person that's going to further your career in the city. So, Paul's answer to them is what? Don't do it. His answer to them is don't do it, but it's not because it's wrong. It's because some other Christian might see you, and they might get emboldened to eat the meat, and for them, being a new convert to Christianity from worshiping these idols, it would be like compromising their own beliefs. And they would be eating it as if it was to the idol. So that's what I think is going on here. Bruce Winter calls these so-called strong, he calls them the theologically nimble. These are the kind of people that can like talk their way out of anything. Elite Christians had enormous social pressure to attend meals at temples. And you know, the question is, can Christian elite go or not? Now let's talk about what animal sacrifices were like, because I'm betting that it's a little different than what you imagine. Maybe not, but I just want to cover it anyhow. Sacrifices happened regularly on altars before the gods, usually on specific days chosen well in advance and happened on the same day every year. Okay, so there was an official calendar. Rome set the calendar and Corinth copied Rome because Corinth is a Roman colony. And when we look at these temples, we see these little altars. Like, well, first of all, number five is probably the most important one. This is an altar that is in the forum. So if you're going to get a lot of people surrounding a sacrificial activity, that's where you want to do it. But we find lots of other altars around the temples. Temples, first of all, would never have an altar inside because the building would light on fire. So you put the altar outside, and then you bring the animal there, and you butcher the animal, and you have a fire on the altar, and then you cook the animal. Clint Burnett has a wonderful description of ancient pagan animal sacrifice that I just think you should hear this. This is good. This is a fabulous book, by the way. Paul and Imperial Divine Honors. Anyhow, Clint, he writes, Offerings would have been offered for the benefit of the entire colony and performed in public view. There's no privacy here. The whole idea of pagan religion was public, public, public. Sacrifices of wine and incense would have been carried out without much work and need to have occurred on the imperial altars in the aforementioned places, but before images painted or statues of Julio Claudian Divi, Octavia, Gaius Caesar, Lucius Caesar, and the reigning emperor's genius set up anywhere in the colony. He's specifically interested in divine honors for imperial people. This would also be true for the other gods I started with. If you were making an offering to Apollo or any of those people, it would be done before their statue if it was something small, like incense or just pouring out a little bit of wine. On the other hand, blood sacrifices would have occurred at the end of sacred processions. This means that imperial flamines would have led in procession local elites, musicians, and victimarii, or special slaves who killed the sacrificed animals, winding their way through the city to the altar that was being used for the ritual in question. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what we call a parade. Okay? A sacred procession. Or like we have this with funerals too, where you have all the cars line up and then they stay in. So that's the sort of thing we're talking about, like a parade of people where they're just lined up and they start in one place and they end at this altar. And once you get to the altar, something happens. He continues, once the imperial procession arrived at the altar, the imperial flamen would have washed his hands with water, burned incense, and poured a libation of wine to the Julio-Claudian Divi, Octavia, Gaius Caesar, Lucius Caesar, or the emperor's genius, or one of those other gods. These sacred rites completed, the imperial flamen would have poured wine and some special flour atop the sacrificial animal's head, as well as run his knife down the beast's back. These acts functioned to transfer ownership of the bull or cow from the imperial flamen and thus Corinth's populace to the object of sacrifice. At this point, the animal was supposed to nod its head and thereby giving consent to be slaughtered. Whereupon the victimarius would have struck the animal on its head to stun it, cut its throat, and drain its blood. Once the beast was dead, a special cultic official known in Latin as a haruspex would have inspected its entrails, liver, lungs, gallbladder, the peritoneum, and heart to ensure that the divis had accepted the offering. If no abnormalities were found, the object was believed to have been acceptable to the divine being to whom it was offered. After such confirmation, the entrails of the animal would have been boiled in a pot. This finished, the flamen would have dumped them, along with more wine and special flour, onto the fires of the altar, where they would have been consumed. Finally, the remainder of the animal would have been divided among the participants and eaten near the imperial altar by the flamen and participants in the procession. Any meat that was not consumed at such a sacrifice was taken to the Mekelem, or meat market, and sold. How's that for a description? I thought that was pretty helpful. Really helped me picture it. I was supposed to tell you what animals. All right, the animals they sacrificed were oxen, female cows, bulls, incense. That's not an animal, but incense and wine. Okay, so those were the offerings that would be made. Anybody killing any animal at any time could do it in honor of a god. Like when you just like kill your nightly chicken. You could do that to Hercules if you were like training for a race. You want a little boost, the competition. What involvement could Christians have? Paul mentioned the scenario of some Christians eating in a temple dining room and getting seen by others. We already talked about that. So his answer to that question is no. Can Christians eat at a temple dining room if it's not during a sacrifice? No, you can't do that, because what if other Christians see you who have a weak conscience and then they get emboldened and you cause them to stumble or sin? All right, still, there's plenty of other questions for us to think about. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul talks about himself as an example of giving up his privileges in order to not cause somebody else to stumble. Okay, so we're going to talk about 1 Corinthians 9 later. It's not going to be for a little while, actually. But it's just like an illustration where Paul uses himself as an illustration. Then, the first half of chapter 10, verses 1 through 13, Paul talks about Israel as a negative example of people who fell into idolatry and then got destroyed because of it. And so he says, look, don't be like the Israelites. And that's where we pick it up in verse 14, where he's going to talk about this one here. Therefore, my beloved, flee from the worship of idols. Yeah, so like on the first question here, should Christians participate in ceremonies honoring gods? His answer is no. How do we know his answer is no? Because he says, run away from it. Flee from the worship of idols. What do you mean, Paul? Why do we have to flee? An idol is nothing in the world. There's no God but one. Why can't I go eat the stupid food? I don't believe in any of their sacred superstition. Well, it's not just superstition. That's Paul's point. Let's look at it. Verse 15. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a sharing in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a sharing in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partners in the altar? What do I imply then? That food sacrificed to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No. I imply that what they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be partners with demons. That's like the mic drop moment here, where he's just like, yo, I'm not worried about the statue here, but there are spiritual forces that are legit, that are powerful, that are malevolent, and that are behind this kind of worship, and that are there in that, if you want to call it sacred space, a space set apart for this religious activity, is a space where he would expect there to be demons, and he doesn't want his people partnering with demons. Paul Gardner writes, for the apostle, these types of religious meals, the Lord's Supper and pagan cult meals, are not mere meals. They are religious activities and are eaten in a context in which the presence of the divinity is assumed. These meals, therefore, speak of allegiance to the God being worshipped by his followers or subjects. He continues, verse 21, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or are we provoking the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? This word partake here is the Greek word koinonia. Koinonia, and it means partake, it means to share, it means to fellowship, it means to associate with. Like, that's what we're doing at communion. We're associating, we're partaking of Christ and of his body and of his blood. I mean, I don't think that's literal. I think there's a lot of symbology happening there, but that's a subject for another day. But okay, so now you're going to do that at a pagan festival to the god Apollo. No, you're not. You're not going to partake of that because it is an actual thing that happens, at least spiritually. Okay, so then we get to verse 23. All things are permitted, but not all things are beneficial. All things are permitted, but not all things build up. He just double-quoted their slogan from chapter 6, which he had already double-quoted earlier. Verse 24, do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. This is his whole point. Do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the grounds of conscience, for the earth and its fullness are the Lord's. So their slogan is everything's permitted. And, you know, maybe that's true in the sense of like, well, you don't have to restrict yourself by the law of Moses anymore or something like that. If that's what they had in mind, I don't know. But they're applying it across the board saying, oh, that means we can use prostitutes. And that means we can go to pagan services and eat their steak. Well, no. Everything is not beneficial and everything does not build up. If what you're doing by your permissiveness in Christ, your liberty in Christ, is causing a fellow Christian to sin, then you're doing it wrong. That's what he's saying to them. But then what he says in verse 25 here is, you know, you can just eat the meat that is sold in the meat market. You don't have to ask questions about it if you have, you know, you're worried about whether this meat was offered to a god or not. Now, when it comes to the meat market, we have an inscription. I couldn't quite make heads or tails of it, but I'll give you a translation. It says, this is an inscription from Corinth. Quintus Cornelius Secundus, son of blank, couldn't read that part, of the tribe of Aemilia, and his wife, Mysia, daughter of Quintus, his son, blank, Cornelius Secundus Mysianus, his son, Quintus Cornelius Secundus, his daughter, Cornelia Secunda, who is the wife of Quintus, Mysias, Cleogenes, the freedman of Quintus Mysias, built the meat market, blank, along with blank, and facilities for fish, blank. All right. Could you put another name on this plaque? You know what I'm saying? Like, this is so, to us, all these centuries later, we look at this, we're like, come on, this is ridiculous. He put his own name, his father's name, his tribe, his wife's father, his two sons, his daughter, his son-in-law, and then his son-in-law's previous master. It's just like, what's going on here? It's about recognition. Corinthians were nuts about recognition. It's not just them. It was in the Roman Empire in general. You know, it was just the way of the world was that you put your name on the plaque and everybody else that you could, because that raises the status of the whole family. And Paul is telling these people, these elite Christian people, you should moderate your behavior based on what a low status Christian who doesn't understand what you're doing could be offended by. It's just like a real shocking way of thinking that must have really grabbed them. Moderate your behavior based on how it may negatively affect others. To us, that is obvious. It's called love. To them, they had never read 1 Corinthians 13 yet. And I don't think it's an accident that 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, is found in 1 Corinthians and not in Philippians or Ephesians or in some other letter to some other place. Couple more quick things about food sacrifice to idols, and then we'll be done. Plutarch talks about attending a fancy dinner between the years 70 and 90 AD. He says, Aristion's cook made a hit with dinner guests, not only because of his general skill, but because the rooster that he set before the diners, though it had been slaughtered as a sacrifice to Heracles, was as tender as if it had been a day old. Aristion said that meat cures rapidly if immediately upon killing it is hung on a fig tree. My point here is twofold. One is that sacrifices to the gods was just part of just regular dinner. This is not a sacred meal. This is not during a big sacrificial festival. This is just dinner. And yet the cook still offered it to a god. And the other thing is that this is obviously good cooking advice for all of us. So I just want to put that out. You know, if you have a fig tree, you hang your rooster on it, it'll be real good. All right. Murphy O'Connor writes about this, about the only time that meat came on the market cheaply in Corinth and elsewhere was during the great pagan festivals. There were so many sacrifices in a short period that neither the participants nor the priests were able to eat all the meat. Typically, only the thigh bones were the god's portion. The surplus meat found its way to the marketplace, but in such quantities that the price was forced down to a level that made meat accessible to the poor. Paul is saying yes to question number three. Can Christians eat the meat from the animal sacrifice when it was sold the next day in the meat market? Yes, you can. Finishing up then, verse 27 of chapter 10. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal, now we've got a hypothetical, and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat it, out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I mean the other's conscience, not your own. For why should my freedom be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why should I be denounced because of that for which I give thanks? Which I think is the only place we see giving thanks for your food in the Bible. Just randomly going to throw that in there. Jesus did bless food. But this is giving thanks. Verse 31, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. So Paul is saying that the meat is not contaminated, but the other person's weak conscience you need to put ahead of your own. So you could eat whatever they serve you at a dinner party, especially if you're at an unbeliever's house. But then if they raise it up and they're like, well, you're a Christian, aren't you? So you shouldn't be eating this. Then you just be like, you're right. I'm not going to eat it. So it's a yes, but maybe no. I didn't really have enough space to write all that in there. I just said yes. All right, so let's talk about application. Don't go to pagan festivals that offer incense, wine, sacrificed animals to other gods. You're a Christian. What's the matter with you? Don't do that. Number two, if you're with a new Christian who's got all kinds of hang-ups and is easily offended, then it is on us who are the strong or the mature to moderate our behavior so that this person is not unnecessarily offended by something that they think is sin, even though it's not sin. Now, you don't want to leave somebody like that forever. People are supposed to mature with time. Okay, so I don't want the old church lady who's like crazy offended by everything everybody does to be running the church and saying, no, you can't do that. Oh, you can't dance. You can't sing. You can't play cards. You know, that's not in the Bible. I'm sorry. We're not going to make a rule because you're, you know, offended by that. But at the same time, if you are working with a new Christian, especially, which is the situation here, then I think it is appropriate to moderate our behavior so that this person would not be offended. All right, that's enough for now. Next time, we'll consider what Corinthians says about who Christ is as we continue in our class, 1 Corinthians in context.
Well, that brings this presentation to a close. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 592, Food Sacrificed to Idols, and leave your comments, questions, and thoughts there. On our last episode, 591, Marriage, Divorce, and Remarriage, John wrote in saying, this is a very timely episode. I was just having a discussion on this topic and this passage a couple days ago with a coworker. His view on divorce and remarriage seems to be that because marriage is a covenant between two people and God, only Christians can truly be considered to be married. Any divorce and remarriage before a person became a Christian would be no different than two people living together without being married. After conversion, divorce is only allowed in cases of infidelity, and remarriage is never allowed. We ended up discussing what actually constitutes being married, and can people who don't believe in God be really married or not? To quote my coworker, if God is not at the center of a marriage, then it's not a real marriage at all. I would appreciate your thoughts on this type of perspective. Thank you so much for the work you have put into this class on Corinthians. It is absolutely fascinating. Well, John, thanks for writing in. Your coworker seems to be kind of an extremist on this subject. I don't believe that a marriage is a covenant made with God. That seems to be the center of his misunderstanding of what marriage is here. You had written that he says marriage is a covenant between two people and God. I don't think so. I think marriage is a covenant between two people, between a man and a woman, where they are covenanting to a commitment with each other. And that is done certainly in the eyes of God or before God or with God's blessing or God's representative as some sort of clergy is present, typically, although certainly not as typical for those outside the church these days. So I would beg to differ with him on that. I would also beg to differ on his point that remarriage is never possible at all, because Paul very clearly says that remarriage is available for those whose spouses have died. In that case, the person is free. They're no longer bound. They're free. And he says only in the Lord to remarry. If they want to remarry, he thinks it's fine to not remarry as well. That's at the end of 1 Corinthians 7, as well as the beginning of Romans 7. So I would differ with him on that. But I'd also differ with him on this idea that non-Christian marriages are all illegitimate. I don't see that in Scripture. In fact, I see the opposite. In the case of the king of Persia, Ahasuerus, and Esther, we don't see any kind of special terminology employed to describe the relationship they have together, other than the traditional language of marriage and wife and so forth. And so also we find in Ezra chapter 9, where there is a major issue with mixed marriages. Those who had returned from exile in Babylon, the Jewish people who had returned, had intermarried with Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. And when Ezra discovered this fact, he was really quite appalled. Not that the Torah forbids mixed marriages. I don't think it does. But it does forbid mixed marriages with the peoples of the land, specifically the ones that I just mentioned. Although I think Egyptians was not against the rules, if I remember correctly. Be that as it may, Ezra chapter 9, verse 2 says, "For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons." So presumably the Canaanite, the Hittite, certainly the Egyptian, and the Moabite, these are people groups that worshipped gods other than Yahweh. Baal, or Isis, Osiris, Ra, and so forth. And as a result, these are good parallels for your friend's example of a marriage between two unbelievers. Atheism just really wasn't a thing, and so we tend to use that term unbeliever. I think actually most, at least in America, people do believe in God. Atheism is not nearly as popular as people have thought it was, at least 10, 15 years ago. It seemed like it was everywhere, but I think that was just kind of the last dying gasps of air before the long quiet rest in peace. Not that there's no atheists anymore, but it's just not a big deal, at least not around me. And I live in a very secular area, but people do in many different ways pay homage to God or talk about higher power or spiritual matters and so forth. I don't want to get too distracted with that. My point is that marriage is done outside of Christianity, either between a Christian and a non-Christian or between two non-Christians, are still marriages. So says the Bible, because Ezra 9:2 says, once again, it says that they have taken of their daughters as wives and for themselves and for their sons. So in other words, even though this person worshiped another god, it was still considered to be a wife. And same thing with Esther. Esther married a pagan. And, you know, I don't think he had much of a choice about the whole matter, but, you know, he still did worship another god. And they ended up putting away all these wives and their children in Ezra chapter 10, which is certainly an unusual kind of mass divorce, but it is considered a divorce and not just ending a cohabitation or something like that. So I think marriage is not just for Christians. I think God designed marriage to be between a man and a woman who get married before God or with God's blessing or to the praise of God, if I can put it that way. But I don't see any indication in the Old Testament or the New Testament that those who are God's people reject the legitimacy of marriages of those not part of God's people. So I would beg to differ with your coworker on that too. On the subject of divorce, he has said that divorce is only legitimate for infidelity. Well, that's certainly one reading of Matthew chapter 19, as well as Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus gives the unchastity or sexual immorality exception clause for divorce. 1 Corinthians 7 also mentions the abandonment scenario by an unbeliever. It says in 1 Corinthians 7:15, "But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. It is to peace that God has called us." Now, interpreters differ over the implication of the statement, "the brother or sister is not bound." I'm reading now from a note in the NET, the NET Bible. It says, "One view is that the believer is not bound to continue the marriage, not so, i.e., not so slavishly tied to the instruction about not divorcing, see verses 10 and 11, that he or she refuses to face reality when the unbelieving spouse is unwilling to continue the relationship." In this view, divorce is allowable under these circumstances, but not remarriage. Verse 11 still applies, which says, remain unmarried or be reconciled. The other view is that the believer is not bound in regard to marriage, i.e., free to remain single or to remarry. The argument for this view is the conceptual parallel with verses 39 to 40, where a wife is said to be bound, which is a different Greek word, but the same idea, as long as her husband lives. But if the husband dies, she is free to marry as she wishes, only in the Lord. If the parallel holds, then not bound in verse 15 also means free to marry another. So that's the point from the NET on this idea of not bound. There are two different interpretations on that. I do take the interpretation that in the case of abandonment, that that person can be remarried. And I have certainly seen this in the course of my own ministry as well. And it's tragic. I've seen this multiple times where a spouse will even leave the country and go to another country and get married to somebody else and have a whole family with somebody else. And then the spouse that's left behind is just stuck. And this person can't get a divorce. They can't get remarried because of the laws of the land. And, you know, this sort of thing, I think, definitely qualifies as the abandonment by an unbeliever. On another point, 1 Corinthians 7:14, I read to you a moment ago, this is the NRSV UE, says, but if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. That phrase, in such a case, is actually a mistranslation. It's the plural there, cases, in such cases. Entis to utis is how I would say that with my modern Greek accent. And that's why the ESV and other translations will say, in such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. And this is extremely significant because what it's saying is, if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not bound. So in other words, not only in the scenario of abandonment by an unbeliever, but other similar types of situations. And Wayne Grudem wrote a technical article on this called Grounds for Divorce, Why I Now Believe There Are More Than Two. He used to believe in only adultery and abandonment, but after comparing the Greek phrase that I just mentioned to you across surviving Greek literature through time, he saw that the phrase refers to other similar situations, which he concludes applies to domestic abuse, where one spouse is physically harming the other. And so Wayne Grudem would give, at least if I remember this correctly, three different cases: the case of adultery, abandonment, and abuse, physical abuse. Others will add more into this little phrase, like alcoholism, drug addiction, gambling addiction, or verbal abuse. And this is where it gets really difficult, especially when we start using the word abuse to refer to any kind of behavior that somebody doesn't like. I think this can easily turn into a slippery slope where we just kind of approve everything and just say, oh, well, they were abusive, you know, they made fun of me, or they refused to engage with me emotionally, or, you know, there are so many different reasons why people get divorced these days along the lines of irreconcilable differences. And I think this is really where you want to have a local church with active elders who can help you figure the situation out. That's literally what the elders are for, is to figure this kind of thing out, to weigh it out, and to help individuals figure out, well, can I fix this marriage? Is there a marriage counseling or some sort of program or a getaway or whatever, like some way to deal with this? Is this marriage salvageable? And then should this person get remarried, or do they have to just remain single or else be reconciled? My current position, in case you're curious, is that divorce is permitted for adultery, abandonment, and physical abuse. I agree with Wayne Grudem on that. Sadly, I've seen all of these throughout the course of my ministry. These are what I would term righteous divorces. In the case of a righteous divorce, as I'm using that phrase, it's my own phrase, the person is free to remarry. They're not married. That's what a divorce is. An unmarried person cannot commit adultery. Think about that for a moment, so long as they marry somebody that's not also married. Divorces because of not getting along, so-called no-fault divorces, I generally see as unrighteous and will not perform marriages for people in those situations, which is most people. This is an extremely difficult and complex topic, and I certainly don't feel too confident in saying for sure I understand it fully. Others draw the line in different places. I'm open to learning here, but this is where I'm at currently, so I figured might as well just come clean because I didn't really say my position last week, and John's pushing me for it. So thanks, John, for that. Well, that's going to be it for today. So that's all we got time for. If you'd like to leave a comment, come on to the website, restitudio.org, where you can also support us financially. So appreciative to those of you who are doing that. It really helped a lot in preparing for this class. If this episode or this class is something that you're really enjoying, please share it with your friends and spread the word. Well, that's going to be it for this week. I'll catch you next time. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.